Good evening, folks, and welcome back on this Saturday, the 20th day of February 2021. I'm your host, Mark Call, and let's begin our look at what's been going on as the formerly free United States tumbles into third world status, since there's so much to cover, more or less chronologically, starting at the beginning. And almost all of this was predictable, and indeed it's stuff that the alternative press, including yours truly, have been warning about for months, if not years. So we'll start with the almost trivial, too, and work our way up while we're at it. Although I guess, since the complete destruction of the rule of law was certainly one of those things we've been warning about, this too is no surprise. Last Saturday, as you probably know, the latest farce in the swamp derailed.
The communists came up a few votes short of being able to pull an actual George Orwell and completely rewrite the history, expunge Donald Trump from the books. That does not, however, mean that the farce is over. It just means the focus will again shift.
But hey, how's that non-existent man-made global warming working out for you? Oh, and have they duped you into taking the poke yet and becoming a human guinea pig? All right, I know regular listeners here haven't been fooled by any of that, but even as the big whopping lies are being revealed, the spin is increasing too, and the pressure will continue to go up. So let me introduce this next, very much expected story with a series of headlines, in more or less chronological order. Power bills to the moon, said a piece from Zero Hedge on Sunday evening. Chaos and shock as electricity prices across the U.S. explode. They started by explaining that as of Thursday, natural gas prices across the Plain States had soared to never-before-seen levels as a result of a brutal polar vortex blast into the central states, which literally froze off the natural gas supply as we began to see what they call wellhead freeze-offs, cutting production receipts just when they're most needed by customers' demand for heating, resulting in warnings that nat gas prices could hit, well, bat-shit levels. And within the next day or so, that happened. Frigid temperatures caused equipment failures, temporary shutdowns, and flaring in at least four natural gas processing plants. And there you go. That nasty supply chain interruption thing rears its ugly head again. And as Zero Hedge and Tyler Durden summarized the markets, we hit the proverbial offerless market, where any nat gas that was available would be purchased at virtually any price, which is why mid-continent prices, such as the OWN-OK OGT natural gas spot, exploded from $3.46 one week ago to $9 on Wednesday, $60.28 on Thursday, and an insane $377.13 on Friday. Up 32,000%, take that Bitcoin, in just a few days. They go through a whole lot more market data from different places across the country and then summarize it this way. One day later, and the peak price in ERCOT West, real time, hit an absolute all-time high of $5,500, up from $302 the day before. So yeah, if anybody has a little extra natural gas in storage, this is the time to sell it and buy a private island. And what's next, if you pay attention to how the dominoes fall? Sure, electricity prices, often produced from natural gas, also going through the roof. Here's the Monday morning headline. Millions of Texans freeze as what they're calling grid chaos sparks massive rolling blackouts. The update says, Oncor Electric Delivery, Texas's largest transmission and electric distribution facility, serving more than 10 million customers, released a rather disturbing statement Monday morning, warning about extended rolling blackouts as temperatures hover around zero. Due to the severity of the electric generation shortfall, it says, our expected outage length of 15 to 45 minutes has been significantly extended. Outages due to this electric emergency could last for hours, and we ask you to, hey, it's about time, folks, be prepared. And it's not like people that are worried about freezing have any issue with power outages now, is it? I wonder how many will be thanking Barack Hussein Obama for managing to get so many nice, inexpensive wood stoves destroyed as a cheap alternative backup heating source, just in case something like this, which they said was not going to happen because of man-made global warming, happened anyway. Late Sunday concludes the piece, ERCOT, the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, which manages the flow of electric power on the Texas Interconnect, set a new winter peak demand record on Sunday, reaching over 69,000 megawatts, they tweeted, between 6 and 7 p.m., and that's more than 3,200 megawatts higher than the previous winter record set back in January of 2018. Explains Zero Hedge, if you're a retailer that's obligated to, say, 25 megawatts and didn't hedge, meaning you left it to get filled by ERCOT at a market clearing price, you just incurred a $7.1 million cost on an around-the-clock basis for a single day. And yes, thousands of businesses will be facing millions of dollars in electricity bills. Not like they have any other economic pressures to deal with now, is it? And we'll come back to that aspect a bit later on. And lastly, but perhaps not leastly, there's this buried deep down within the many stories about the emergency declaration for Texas amid the energy issues and the severe winter storms and so forth. The CEO of ERCOT, Bill Magness, in a press release on Sunday said, "We've experienced record-breaking electric demand, blah-de-blah-de-blah. But at the same time," he added, "we're dealing with higher-than-normal generation outages." You ready for this, folks? "Due to frozen wind turbines and limited natural gas supplies available to generating units. We're asking Texans to take these simple, safe steps to lower their energy use during this time." And what that means is that about half of West Texas's wind turbine capacity, 25,000 megawatts worth, was literally iced out as of Sunday morning, as wind-generated power, thanks to perverse incentives and things that tend to make un-cost-effective alternatives seem like more of a real alternative than they really are, has increased to overtake clean coal-generated power. In 2020, they note 23% of energy supplied to the state's power grid was wind-generated. That is, when the wind blows and when the wind turbines aren't broken or iced out. I bet you two things at this point. There are probably some power generation managers that are thinking, "Oh, for the good old days when we had clean coal and we had piles and piles of it stacked out behind the plant there, we could just send another front-end loader out and pick a bunch up. And by the way, we could buy it when it was cheap and have it on hands for occasions just like this." And what's the other thing you can almost certainly count on? Nobody in the District of Criminal Swamp is going to be talking about that or even allowing their captive press to ask the question. Let me summarize all of this, folks, without having to say, those words that end with, "I told you so." For literally years, we've been hearing about man-made global warming. And as it turned out that there wasn't any global warming, and it sure as you know what wasn't man-made, the tune changed. Now it's climate change. And, oh, you can expect that one will get hammered real good now, since it's been proven that they were wrong, but they're going to lie about it. And, of course, if everybody's been convinced by the liars in the press they need to be buying bikinis, there hasn't been a lot of preparation for a nasty extended winter or backup heating issues. And I guess on that score, the old saying still applies, fool me once, shame on you, fool me over and over and over again, well, maybe I'll freeze to death. Or let you destroy my business, my country, my children's futures, and, yeah, my immune system, too. The bottom line, folks, is that we've seen an entire economy deliberately gutted, dumbed down, and set up for a series of takedowns, and this is not the end of it yet, exactly like this. And I can't help but point out, yeah, if you think this is bad, wait till you see what they've already done to the food supply. By the end of the week, as at least some of the crisis seemed to be abating a bit, with warmer temperatures to boot, some of the figurative smoke began to clear, and there was even talk about lessons learned, at least among the alternative and preparedness communities. It was also admitted that Texas actually came just moments away from what was called a catastrophic failure that could have resulted in worse blackouts, potentially lasting, quote, for months. According to ERCOT, the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, which operates the power grid for most of the state, the "we almost got there" worst case scenario involves power demand which outstrips the supply of generation available, check, causing equipment to catch fire, substations to blow, and power lines to go down. And if the grid had gone totally offline, they say, the physical damage to power infrastructure from overwhelming the grid could have taken not days, but months to repair, said Bernadette Johnson, Senior VP of Power and Renewables at Enverus, an oil and gas software and info company headquartered in Austin. Water delivery too fell victim, notes Michael Snyder at the Economic Collapse blog. Cold weather in Texas literally caused thousands of pipes to burst, and the damage caused by at least 797 water systems in the state that are currently reporting frozen or broken pipes will amount to the billions of dollars. And that number evidently doesn't even include homeowners, who've also seen more than their share of broken pipes and water damage. But that's not all. After reporting earlier in the week on wholesale power prices, which jumped from $50 per megawatt to more than $9,000, hammering a lot of power companies' bottom lines, the horror stories are now pouring in from those who had power outages this week, but still saw their power bill skyrocket in a mind-boggling fashion. Texans who were put on a variable or index plan with power companies are only now reporting their bills have jumped hundreds, if not thousands, of dollars for the month. Roy Pierce told Newsweek he owes his power company, Gritty, $8,162.73 for his electric usage this month. And that's a massive increase from his usual $387 bill. Other customers reported power bills at $2 per kilowatt hour, about a dozen times higher than normal. And Ty Williams told WFAA that his average electric bill of about $660 a month has now exploded to the point that he owes $17,000. By the way, folks, in this neck of the woods, that'd go a long ways towards paying for a decent off-grid solar system. OilPrice.com even went through the numbers of how much it would have cost to charge a Tesla in Texas earlier this week. While a regular charge costs about $18, using a level 1 or 2 charger at home, estimates now show that the surge in power prices this week would have made that same charge for your Tesla run about $900. How's that for feeling the green? The best postmortem, though, may come from Carl Denninger in a piece entitled The Third World Comes to Texas, where he explains what happened and why it's not going to get better anytime soon. The Bidens and AOCs of the world, he says, are literally going to kill you. Here's the key, folks, and why, back when we had a constitution, politicians weren't supposed to be doing engineering. Texas, he says, like so many other areas, has put up windmills and solar farms for the last 20 years, shutting down older coal-fired plants and not modernizing or improving their fossil fuel energy production infrastructure. At the same time, though, on a national basis, the natural gas pipeline operators, in service to the woke green mob, have replaced fuel-fired pumps that run on gas in the pipe and therefore are fail-safe, so long as the pipe has something in it and is intact, with electrically powered booster pumps, because, of course, you can get all the power for them from green sources instead of that evil carbon. I remind you, says Denninger, natural gas doesn't freeze at other than cryogenic temperatures, and as such, the problem is not the gas freezing, and as for machinery, you have plenty of heat sources in the pipe. But by putting up with the woke mob and responding to their idiocy, instead of immediately frying and eating their entire bloodline, okay, well, he's being a little hyperbolic, I think, but maybe it'll come to that. These companies took an ultra-reliable and essential energy delivery system that, other than by physical destruction, would nearly always continue to operate and turned it into something so fragile that it was dependent on multiple outside elements, where if any of those elements fail, so does the natural gas delivery. Almost like they intended to destroy the system, isn't it? And since non-engineers think that maybe it's air conditioning that's the big deal, so let's take the nuclear power plants offline and do maintenance during the winter. Oops, they forgot about mandated heat pumps and how they really, really use a lot of power as reverse air conditioners when it gets cold outside. Oh, and who could have thought we'd actually have cold? We were supposed to have global warming out the wazoo by now anyway. There are lessons that should be learned here, folks. But how many times does the left have to prove to us that they're simply unteachable and unredeemable? This next item comes courtesy of the MarketTicker.org and Carl Denninger in a thread that outlines at least one of the potential vulnerabilities of the COVID-1984 vaccine. It's something your hostess talked about when it comes to the idea of a two-part bioweapon, but I thought this was a particularly interesting take. Coronaviruses, says the piece, are notorious for what are called ADE reactions. That stands for antibody-dependent enhancement, where antibody presence potentiates the infection instead of actually protecting against it. He goes on to say the poster child for ADE and coronaviruses was an attempted vaccine for a feline coronavirus that often made cats very sick. Trouble is, the vaccine killed every single one of them in the test when they were later exposed to the real virus, which potentiated the infection wildly. So read that again, says the piece. Not one vaccinated cat survived a challenge with the actual virus. Now, ordinary vaccines we have a lot of experience with, like measles, the flu shot, mumps, and similar, do not carry, well, at least this is the claim here, too much of a risk beyond that of natural infection, and they aren't normally weaponizable because they produce the same exact antibody response, because that's generally the point of injecting the virus into somebody, as a natural infection. If you've had either the measles, in other words, or the shot, you'll have the antibodies, but an antibody test won't tell you which, since they're not distinguishable. The way the mRNA shots work, though, they're not actually a vaccine, as you've probably heard from those people that are honestly reporting on the situation. They don't mimic natural infections, but instead, they cause your DNA to be modified and thus cause the cells to produce the spike protein that the virus has, and that elicits an immune response. The antibodies produced by these jabs would be distinct and therefore distinguishable from natural infection. And all of the so-called experts who worked to develop these and the firms who did it knew damn well that this was the case when they started developing them. But they did it anyway. And now we have hard scientific confirmation of that, and it's very bad indeed. In fact, potentially even nation-ending bad. An adversary able to develop a virus, for example, another modified mutated bat virus or whatever it might be, that selectively targets ADE in people with the specific antibodies from vaccination, which are distinct from a natural infection, could easily kill every single person who was vaccinated, and either not harm or only make mildly sick those who had either COVID-19 naturally or who were uninfected and unvaccinated. The nightmare scenario that's always driven bioweapons research, continues the piece, is the push to discover some genetically distinct means of targeting a bioweapon so that it only kills the desired adversary and leaves everybody else alone. It's even worse for your adversary if your side gets and transmits the bug, but doesn't get sick. And so far, at least as far as we've been told, maybe we should ask Fauci, but we know he'd lie, this has never been found despite diligent effort in the past. All attempts to find such a distinct vulnerability have failed, showing reactivity across the board, and thus strongly suggesting that if such a thing was completed and got out, it would probably end up killing indiscriminately. He doesn't mention it, but of course, if it mutates, that's even more true. Thus, you cannot stop a virus from circulating. Even isolated islands, he notes, eventually got hit by the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic. It means that releasing a virus or bacteria that nobody on your side has been sensitized to yet doesn't help, because when, not if, that sensitizing agent gets into your population, all your people would die too. So, for the first time in history, this has now been changed by the idiotic actions of governments and pharmaceutical companies in a way that we're now literally tagging people for death by the literal millions. And they will die if an adversary is able to develop a virus that targets those specific antibodies. Unquote. I gotta add this, folks. What if the adversary already had that part B before they released the part A of the plandemic to begin with? The story goes on to say this, and maybe he's soft-pedaling it even a bit more than I just did. Of course, the adversary will not deploy the tagging via said shots in their own population, and thus their people will not be attacked and killed. And since it takes an actual jab of the needle to be sensitized, absent other intentional action, there's no risk to the adversary's population or his troops. So, continues the author, I'd give the odds of an adversary, remember, we're talking nations here with nearly unlimited resources and plenty of smart people, arguably they've been working on this for a while anyway, figuring out how to selectively target COVID-19 vaccination antibodies at better than 50% or so odds within the next 5 years. Know this, if they succeed, every single person who took one of those vaccines that produces a distinguishable antibody titer dies. So you can bet your last nickel they're working on it right now. Or I'll say it again, they may have already had it before they even released Part A. What happens if they succeed, notes this piece, and we forcibly vaccinated our children and anyone who claims they want a normal life, yeah sure, back? The entire procreation-capable stock of people in the United States will die, and so will America. Oh, and by the way, folks, how about if Bill Gates and the other eugenicists are simply able to stick fertility-destroying agents into the jab to begin with? Doesn't even take an adversary. Well, it does have an adversary. It's just not the one people have been told. That risk, says this piece, is wildly beyond the boundaries of sanity to have ever been accepted, and it's been deliberately concealed from the people who are taking the poke, not just here, but throughout the Western world. So it's clearly not enough for certain ghouls to have destroyed a full year of most school-aged children's education. Well, they've been destroying their education by dumbing them down for longer than that. At least you get the point. Now they're proposing to risk literally extinguishing all of their lives and thus future generations that they would be able to create down the road. Pray, this author says, that I'm wrong. And note that the use of any so-called vaccine that doesn't end up producing an identical antibody to natural infection should be halted immediately and never done again. We can't do anything for the people that have already been stabbed, but we can eliminate the incentive to produce such an incredible bioweapon by not having a material percentage of the productive and young population able to be selectively targeted. So I can't help but think, folks, that that's an excellent point. By now, lots of people, including your host, have reported for years on the idea of developing a race-specific bioweapon. Look at most of the press, and certainly some of the scumbags on the House floor. You can imagine what they would do with it if they had it. And even absent the information presented in this piece, that's a perfectly good reason not to trust those people or take anything that they want to poke you with to begin with. Carl Denninger's insight takes that one important step further. I call it food for thought. Finally, a sad note, although not unexpected. Radio legend Rush Limbaugh, arguably the most influential talk show host of any of our lifetimes, passed away on Wednesday of cancer at the age of 70. I saw this comment online. It certainly bears repeating. As many of you may recall, one of his signature lines was, "Talent on loan from God." Well, that talent has now returned to its creator. And as I was thinking this morning about his life and the influence that he's had on so many of us, while I was milking the goats, as it turned out, I realized that while doing talk radio has given me the opportunity to talk to a whole bunch of wonderful and interesting people via interviews or even call-ins that I never would have had the opportunity to meet otherwise, Rush Limbaugh, unfortunately, at least in my case, was not one of them. I certainly tried calling in a number of times, and most of that was long before I started doing radio myself, never managed to get through even to get a ring on the other end. But as I was recalling all of that this morning, it did occur to me that, in spite of the fact that I never did so on the phone, I did have the pleasure, quite a few years ago, of meeting and talking with his right-hand man, Rush liked to call him Bo Snerdly, here in Colorado, in an event that I realized today I was actually thankful to have been privileged to attend. Yeah, you may have heard of it. It was called Dan's Bake Sale. I had to look it up online to remember exactly when it was. May 22nd, 1993. And the story, to some extent, at least kind of helps illustrate how Rush got to be who and where he was. Ostensibly, it had to do with Rush's subscriber publication called The Limbaugh Letter. And a fellow named Dan called into the show from Fort Collins, Colorado, to tell him that he was bootlegging his newsletter because he couldn't afford the $29.95 subscription price. And in those days, the Clinton regime was getting a lot of press about asking kids to have bake sales to help reduce the national debt. Yeah, sure. In any case, it was a running joke. And so Rush asked Dan, "Why don't you have a bake sale to raise money so you can pay me for the letter?" And just for fun, as the story now goes, Rush said, "I think I'm going to go to Dan's bake sale if he has one." And that's all it took. The die was cast, say all kinds of people who helped set up what followed. The date was set, and Rush said he was coming. In the Colorado Front Range, there was a whole lot of coverage. Yours truly, of course, already had my Cessna 182 Skylane by then. I kept it at the Longmont Airport, which turns out to be only a few minutes by air from Fort Collins downtown. A nice little quiet strip that I practiced landings at while I was learning to fly, and in those days still frequently flew up to because there was a really nice steak place we could walk to for dinner or lunch. Turned out it was a beautiful day. We filled up the plane and flew up, and I was amazed on the way up as I overflew I-25 and saw cars and buses literally lined up all the way to the interstate and down towards Denver. We'd been planning on walking from the airport down to the event. I don't remember exactly how we got there, but I do remember that getting a ride both directions was not a problem. Didn't actually get to meet Rush in person, although we did come pretty close, but we did have a great time, and it was certainly memorable. As Ron Kreider for KNUS AM 710, Rush's local affiliate at the time, later wrote, "Dan showed up with 36 store-bought cookies that sold out in 5 minutes, and as it turns out, so did at least 30,000 people. Most reports say the number was probably closer to 70,000 in Fort Collins. There were no police incidents whatsoever. There was no mess to clean up when the 8-hour event was over, and as Kreider puts it, the only incident was when Dan himself passed out from the heat." Whereupon Ron Kreider's wife, Molly Snell Kreider, on hand as the official event nurse, brought him back around quickly. And I reminisce my way through that story, folks, for a number of reasons. Things like, it's important to remember how people now past have managed to touch our lives, and not the least of which, although sadly, it reminds us of just how much things have changed, in spite of the best efforts of people like Rush Limbaugh. May he rest in peace. I drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry, and
Them good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye, singing, "This'll be the day that I die. This'll be the day that I die." Did you write the book of love, and do you have faith in God above? If the Bible tells you so, do you believe in rock and
roll. Welcome back now to the second segment of the show for this evening. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and we'll continue this theme of things that should have been reported, and in fact, we did here. They've been a long time coming, but now they're undeniable, even in the waste stream, where the lie has finally fallen apart. Case in point. First from Zero Hedge, under a headline about soaring food costs that are finally being passed on to consumers. Well, at least so they'll notice. The cost of living, says the piece from Tyler Durden, is about to soar, and all the average Joe has to cover is a $1,400 check from Uncle Joe. In this case, it's Beijing Biden, not his comrade and socialist mentor, Uncle Joe Stalin. Although, admittedly, if you confuse them, I can understand. Last year, they say, we noted that Albert Edwards of SocGen had been warning readers that it could be time to start panicking about soaring food prices. That was quite a while ago again, folks. Edwards' research back then said, keep a very close eye as to whether or not we see a repeat of the 2010-2011 surge in food prices. Because, quote, on the 10th anniversary of the start of the Arab Spring, and with poverty having already been made much worse by the pandemic, another food price bubble could well be the straw to break the very angry camel's back. That seems to have been the case then. Now it's obvious. While it's not quite the spring of 2021 yet, continues Tyler Durden, there are indications already that soaring food costs are about to get passed on to consumers, which is terrible news for working poor folks already suffering from housing and food insecurities. This time, Reuters is saying that Kraft Heinz Company and Conagra Brands warned Tuesday that price increases of wheat, sugar, and other commodities are becoming more expensive due to elevated demand. Hint, that ain't all, folks. And executives told Reuters that increased prices for edible oils, pork, eggs, and packaging, too, might force it to pass all of this along to consumers in the form of higher prices. And the CEO of Kraft Heinz, Miguel Patricio, said inflation is everywhere in the agricultural complex, especially everything related to grains is being observed, and it may result in price increases in some categories, including things like mac and cheese, mayonnaise, later on in the year. And it comes at the worst possible time because, of course, consumers are already more than strapped. Millions can barely afford rent and or feed their families. And let me add one more note here, folks, before we continue with the saga. We've been seeing higher prices for quite some time, been reporting on it here as well. But for the most part, higher inflation has been in the form of hidden inflation, where the, let's just say, cagey packaged food producers are keeping the packaging the same and putting less stuff inside. Sometimes they'll put a little note at the bottom that says 14 ounces when you could have sworn it was 16 ounces not long ago. Oh, well, the box looks the same. Even Bloomberg is finally having to admit the obvious, saying there are signs that the food inflation that's gripped the world over the past year, raising prices of everything from shredded cheese to peanut butter, is about to get worse. The COVID-1984 pandemic, they of course don't spell it right, upended food supply chains. Well, to be truthful, folks, it was the governmental over-response that did that. It also paralyzed shipping, sickening workers, at least that's what we're being told, that keep the world fed and ultimately raising consumer grocery costs around the globe last year. But now farmers, especially ones raising cattle, hogs, and poultry, are being squeezed by the highest corn and soybean prices in 7 years. Gee, didn't we talk about that in the fall after that nasty harvest and broken supply chain? Anyway, they're getting squeezed by the highest corn and soy prices in 7 years, lifting the costs of feeding their herds by over 30%. And to stay profitable, producers, including Tyson Foods, are increasing prices, which will ripple through the supply chains and show up in coming months as higher price tags for beef, pork, and chicken around the world become harder and harder to deny. And did you notice that said producers? Doesn't necessarily mean the farmers aren't getting squeezed harder than ever. Oh, well, if they end up going out of business, you know what'll happen. Bill Gates and the globalists will just buy them out, and on the cheap, of course, and then we can look forward to real food price inflation. They quote Mark Gordon, managing director to British chicken and turkey producer Traditional Norfolk Poultry, who said, "Feed prices go up and down, you tend to take the rough with the smooth, but when it rallies as much as it has, it starts to impact massively on businesses." And the last time the piece says that grains were this expensive was during the drought in the U.S. of 2012, when meat prices saw a dramatic run-up. Now meat is again poised to be a driver of global food inflation and part of the intensifying debate, they say, over the path of overall inflation and just exactly what central banksters and policymakers should do to aid economies still working to recover from the pandemic that they used to hammer it to pieces before. What do you think central banksters and policymakers ought to do, folks? Quit throttling things. You know darn well what they are going to do, though. They're going to crank it down, and they're going to open the money spigot and print, print, print. This last line would even be funny if it wasn't such a huge whopper. Vaccinations, they say, promise a return to normal life.
That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Oh, and fiscal stimulus programs amounting to trillions of bucks are already expected to unleash pent-up demand and drive a surge in consumer prices. Gee, do you think? One more related story as we segue onto non-existent man-made global warming. An InfoWars summary of a whole bunch of video and photos up online says, shocking footage out of Austin shows long lines of desperate Texans queuing up to try to enter grocery stores as extreme cold weather conditions stretch into their third day and many continue to be without power. There are pictures from grocery stores all over the area showing people having walked for miles, but when they get there, only 15 items per person. Well, I had to walk, can't carry that much anyway. The lines are absolutely crazy, say observers. Hundreds in line. They're thankful that the food stores are even open. Ran out of food at one store, so I had to walk over to HEB. Didn't think I'd have to wait in line there, too, says one of the typical captions. And they're finding, kind of like in other communist countries, a lot of the store shelves have already been emptied. Just two comments on this story, folks, and they both have to do with preparation. Or, maybe better put, lack thereof. I guess you can do it in one word each. Food and power. Which brings me next to what I guess I'm going to have to call the stupid summary. I don't know, maybe I should go with idiocy on parade. Epitomized by a photo that I've now seen several places on the web of a helicopter hovering over a frozen boondoggle, publicly subsidized, allegedly green but massively inefficient, and really downright wasteful wind turbine. What was the helicopter doing? Spraying a de-icing solution, ethylene glycol, I presume, from on high, to try to unfreeze the frozen blades of the power source, sick, that's been used to gut Texas's infrastructure to the point where they're this vulnerable to political correctness. Now, I have to make one other observation. How much fossil fuel do you think that helicopter was burning while it was trying to put a windmill back online that probably won't produce as much power for days and days as it took that helicopter to try to unfreeze it? And one more observation that somehow kind of fits here too, folks. You've probably heard this, unless you get your political opinions from the leftist press. These massive windmills, when you count the cost of the mining, the ore production, the steel, and all the other manufacturing, actually require more energy to build, and let's not forget maintain, than they'll return during their useful life. So I'll say it again. It's simple math. If you powered the world with this kind of stupidity, it would eventually run down. And for more, we turn to Miss Shedlock via Mish Talk and Zero Hedge, who writes, "Hello, clean energy, sick advocates. What do we do when the wind turbines are all frozen?" And he begins by noting what we've talked about here for the last couple of days. The wholesale price of electricity spiked 10,000% during the recent Texas power outage, and among other problems, the wind turbines are all frozen. Even the Wall Street Journal gets this one right, as their editorial board says, power shortages show the folly of eliminating natural gas and coal. And as gas and power prices have spiked across the central U.S., while Texas regulators order rolling blackouts, we find that the Arctic blast has also frozen wind turbines, and herein lies the paradox of the left's bogus, I put that word in there, climate agenda. The less we use fossil fuels, the more we need them. The problem? Cold snaps happen. The U.S. also experienced a polar vortex in 2019, as do heat waves. Yet, the power grid is becoming less and less reliable due to growing reliance on bogus non-alternatives, even though they say otherwise, like wind and perhaps to a lesser degree solar, which cannot provide power 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And since massive subsidies encourage their use, wind share has tripled to about 25% since 2010 and accounts for 42% of power last week, at least it did, in Texas before the freeze set in. And about half of Texans also rely on electric heat pumps for warmth, which the leftists want to mandate everywhere. And hasn't that proven to be a great bit of idiocy? The pumps, though, use a whole lot of power in frigid weather. They get dramatically less efficient, folks, as the outside air temperature drops. So while wind turbines were freezing, demand for power was surging. And wouldn't you know it, not too many people, being ill-prepared, have a decent backup heat source either. And you know darn well that drinking the non-existent man-made global warming Kool-Aid hasn't helped on that front. Continues the WSJ, California progressives long ago banished coal, but a heat wave last summer strained the state's power grid as wind flagged and solar ebbed in the evenings, and after imposing rolling blackouts there, grid regulators resorted to importing, what, coal power from Utah, which hasn't gone quite so insane, and running diesel emergency generators. I guess that's at least more efficient than trying to send out a helicopter to unfreeze your wind turbines. So, concludes the Wall Street Journal, and I would say correctly, the Biden regime's plan to banish fossil fuels is a greater existential threat to Americans than climate change. And that's a bit like saying communist China is a greater existential threat to Americans than the tooth fairy. Ms. Shedlock tells us he's a bigger fan of clean natural gas than coal. And although he does tend to overlook clean coal and what's been done to clean up coal emissions in general, he does get this part right. The byproduct of burning natural gas is nothing but carbon dioxide and water, and plants need both in order to survive. But remember, folks, never try to confuse a knee-jerk leftist with actual scientific facts. Because, but, carbon bad! And besides, they'd ban hydrogen dioxide if they could, too. He goes through the so-called carbon footprint numbers, too, as if they actually mattered, saying the U.S. reduced its from 6.13 billion tons in 2007 to 5.28 as of 2019. And you know the pandemic throttled it even more. Hey, what an amazing coincidence. Well, communist China's output has increased 150% over that same time frame, meaning that the U.S. contribution to the booga, booga, booga global carbon footprint from less than 20% to now less than 15% of the world's total anyway. Not that it matters. And even the nutcases admit the costs of things like the Green New Deal will exceed $90 trillion, and that's with a T, dollars. And what does all that mean? By the time the world is forced to admit that there is no such thing as man-made global warming, and just maybe the sun might have something to do with a cooling climate, those that haven't already starved to death will freeze in their power-deprived homes. Oh no, wait a minute, I forgot. By then they'll have already been moved back into the central city, so maybe their combined body warmth and their 100-square-foot apartments can help them stay warm. And before we move on, one more bit of absurdity now made clear. Ask yourself just how well those people who were suckered into buying an electric car are managing to get around with the power grid down. Why, come to think of it, they can't even go out and sit in them and run the engine to keep warm.
Are you crazy? Or just plain stupid?
Stupid is stupid does, Mrs. Blue.
I guess.
And yeah, that too, they also intend to mandate. All of which inclines me to repeat a truism I've used now for quite a few years. Never ascribe to conspiracy that which can be explained by stupidity. Trouble is, there comes a point at which you realize nobody, especially not anybody in a position of power, could really truly be quite that stupid. So where does that leave us? Well, lest we have any doubts on that score, let's turn next to the medical tyranny front and a piece about Florida and California, which we're told took opposite approaches to the booga booga flu and the COVID-1984 pandemic in totalitarian California. Of course, it was Achtung, lock everything down and destroy literally everything that doesn't move. While in Florida, there was a more laissez-faire, live and let live, and hey, maybe the science really ought to matter approach. Interestingly though, they've come up with approximately similar results. In fact, in spite of the negative press, Florida comes out looking at least slightly better on almost every metric. How is it, says Tyler Durden for Zero Hedge, that California enacted their draconian COVID lockdown measures and yet had nearly identical results to Florida, a state which went out of its way to avoid shackling residents with small business-killing prohibitions and mentally unhealthy isolation? According to an analysis by none other than the left-leaning UK Daily Mail, California Governor Gruesome Newsom and his strict lockdowns resulted in 8,499 cases, and remember, those cases are largely bogus too, and 130 deaths per 100,000 residents. While Florida Governor Ron DeSantis' hands-off approach, including lifting an ordinance preventing people from operating businesses and restaurants, has resulted in a little bit less, 8,306 cases and 117 deaths per 100,000 residents. Not only that, it says both states followed roughly the same trajectories, and the charts make that really clear, for various COVID-19 metrics, with Florida actually looking better by virtually every measure when adjusted for population, and California looking like Orwellian overlords, save for multiple judges who've tossed out some of Newsom's edicts because the state failed to provide a scientific basis for their decisions, and has concealed the fact that their methodology has driven business-killing decisions. No, Florida didn't shut down schools, nor did they impose statewide mask mandates, and the Daily Mail at least touched on the fact that there is a demographic issue between Florida and California. More than one-fifth, or 21% of Florida's population, is at least 65 years old, with at least 4.6 million out of the state's 22 million identifying as senior citizens. And by comparison, just 15% of California's population is elderly, 6 million out of 40 million are age 65 and up. Meaning, says the Daily Mail, that more residents in Florida are susceptible to a virus that preys on the elderly. Well, which is true, noted Ben Shapiro, critiquing at least some of the things the Daily Mail overlooked, except for the fact that Florida has the second oldest population in America, while California has the fifth youngest. Florida's unemployment rate is 6.1% versus California's 9.0%, and Florida, he notes, is free and wonderful, while California has become an authoritarian hellhole. All right, well, when all is said and done, I have to admit that at least the Daily Mail headline is reasonably accurate. Do lockdowns, they ask, really make a difference? How two U.S. states with totally opposite COVID strategies both ended up with the same result? Well, okay, we'll let that one slide. California Governor Gavin Newsom, they say, took a very strict approach during the coronavirus pandemic and closed bars and indoor dining, issued mask mandates, and limited gatherings. By comparison, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has issued very few closures and said he trusted Floridians to use common sense to control the spread of the virus. So, after a bunch of charts, they say, were lockdowns necessary and did they work? The answer is a complicated one, and they're not about to go into too much detail as to why that might be. Instead, they prefer to rely vaguely on, quote, some researchers and, interestingly, not others. Studies, it says, have shown that stay-at-home orders, oh, and note, too, that it's never had to been done before in history, and we've never had such a great economic collapse before either, although we've certainly had far, far, far more deadly actual pandemics. So, yes, studies have shown, they say, although other studies, not noted, say it's a bunch of BS, that stay-at-home orders and restrictions save numerous lives. Yes, believe us, because we keep repeating it. But they might be less useful now, as more of the population gains natural immunity through infection or immunity via vaccination. Note, even here, folks, they don't mention the fact that a lot of people are taking vitamin D, vitamin C, and taking care of their immune systems, and they don't have to worry about the booga-booga flu to begin with. That kind of an unconscionable omission really does make me mad at this point. And it helps if you don't recirculate your own exhaust gases and wear masks that encourage gum inflammation and bacterial pneumonia, while raising the CO2 and decreasing the oxygen in your bloodstream. But they continue to parrot the claim that, quote, social distancing and masks are still necessary to continue driving down case and death rates, unquote. And here maybe you thought that if they quit pushing so many false positives, the case numbers would also decline now that we have a communist in the White House. After some spin like that, we do need to take off the mask and breathe some actual oxygen, get the blood flowing again in the brain. So we turn to the burning platform and a guest post by Robert F. Kennedy, Jr. of Children's Health Defense, who tells us, I hope you're sitting down for this one, that the media is continuing to push vaccine misinformation. Oh, and by the way, get this, the Fulton County Medical Examiner, he writes, said that the coroner never actually saw baseball great Hank Aaron's body, much less conducted an examination. So by implying that the Fulton County coroner conducted an autopsy, sources like the New York Times and others deceived their readers. He begins by noting that last month the mainstream media attacked me in a regimented swarm, debunking, and he puts it properly in quotes, my quote in the Defender, questioning whether or not Hank Aaron's death may have been related to the Moderna COVID-19 vaccine that he received just 18 days earlier. I never said, notes RFK Jr., that the Moderna shot caused Aaron's death. I simply made the factual observation that, quote, Aaron's tragic death is part of a wave of suspicious deaths among elderly closely following administration of COVID vaccines, unquote. And he says, among the apoplectic hive of so-called fact-checkers that condemned this statement as misinformation were Meet the Press, NBC, The New York Times, The WAPO, USA Today, The Chicago Tribune, Inside Edition, and a whole bunch more. The Daily Beast headline summarized the media's moral revulsion at my query by saying, quote, RFK Jr. stoops to new low by falsely tying Hank Aaron's death to vaccine. And shortly after this, as listeners here know, he was deplatformed by Instagram. The New York Times even came out with this whopper. Citing the Fulton County Coroner's Office, they assured the public that, quote, the COVID vaccine did not kill Hank Aaron. And NBC's National Wire Service reported that the Fulton County Coroner declared that Aaron's death was, quote, from natural causes unrelated to the vaccine, unquote. Trouble is, in an embarrassing disclosure for the mainstream media, which he refers to as the mainstream FAR media, P-H-A-R, the coroner's office in Fulton County has now denied that any of its staff actually ever saw Aaron's body, much less conducted any examination. Says RFK, a Fulton County medical examiner told me directly, quote, his body was never here. We declined jurisdiction. There was never any autopsy. And the only person that actually claimed Aaron's death was from natural causes was his personal physician. So there was never any necropsy or post-mortem investigation. And by implying that the Fulton County coroner actually conducted an autopsy, which it did not, the New York Times and other media outlets have deceived their readers. And hey, folks, it's hardly the first time or the most deadly now, is it? And here's the upshot here. They railed on him for even suggesting a correlation between a whole bunch of old people taking the vaccine and many of them suddenly dropping dead. How could that possibly be related to the vaccine? But on the other hand, the so-called fact-checkers don't seem to be ashamed that they falsely claimed that the coroner exonerated the Moderna vaccine. From there, RFK Jr. goes into some actual scientific detail that tends to glaze over the eyes of the so-called fact-checkers, noting that vaccine deaths are downright difficult to diagnose. Under the best of circumstances, they're notoriously difficult, if not impossible, to diagnose. So difficult, in fact, that doctors miss more than 99% of them, according to a 2010 U.S. Department of Health and Human Services study. And vaccine injuries wear so many guises that nobody even knows, for the most part, what they look like. Manufacturers, U.S. Food and Drug Administration required product inserts on the 16 vaccines that the CDC recommends for children list some 400 ways that vaccines can kill or injure people. Everything from heart attacks, myocardial infarction, strokes, seizures, tachycardia, to a long list of allergies and reactions, encephalopathy, anaphylaxis, autoimmune injuries, blood clots, brain swelling, and so on and so forth. Vaccine injuries and deaths generally, he says, result from aggravations of existing comorbidities, too. But since the vaccine rarely leaves a distinctive fingerprint, there's almost no way to determine if the vaccine triggered the fatal event, even with an extensive autopsy, which, of course, they didn't do. Kennedy says one of the reasons he went to the Fulton County Coroner's Office was that he was curious to know what cutting-edge test the medical examiner might have performed that would so definitively rule out a vaccine as even a contributing culprit. Still, though, in cases before the Vaccine Court or the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, the government routinely takes the reflexive position that something else, just about anything else, caused the injuries. In spite of which, they still paid out $4.5 billion for vaccine injuries, indemnifying the manufacturers and distributors. And the deciding factor in most of these cases, he writes, is timing. If the injury or death associated with the vaccine occurred within a few days or maybe weeks following inoculation, the court is more likely to assume some culpability. And note, folks, that's what we're seeing among so many of the elderly here, not to mention quite a few younger guinea pigs as well. From there, Kennedy goes on to criticize the VAERS system. It's utterly dysfunctional, punishes doctors who report vaccine risks. The media acts in coordination with the medical establishment to suppress acknowledgement of vaccine injuries as well, with the result that existing dangerous vaccines are allowed to remain on the market. And what we're talking about in the case of an essentially untested, potentially lethal mRNA set of vaccines being mass delivered to what amount to human guinea pigs at warp speed goes far, far beyond anything we've ever seen before. Somehow this comes to mind. Caveat emptor. The Bible puts it a bit more plainly. Don't be deceived.